Achilles' wrath, to Greece the direful spring of woes unnumbered, heavenly goddess, sing. That wrath which hurled to Hades' gloomy reign the souls of heroes too untimely slain. Declare, O Muse, in what ill-fated hour sprung that fierce strife, from what offended power. In 2016, 4,000 environmentalists in Germany shut down a coal mine. Germany has a lot of coal mines. In fact, they account for 7 of the 10 biggest CO2 emitters in Europe. So activists from the Ende Gelände movement blockaded the Garzweiler mine and the power station next door to it, which is called... which is called... Schwarzpump. I think I saw Schwarzpump performing at Harpies last week. They broke down a few fences and sprayed some graffiti, but mainly they just stood in the way of the machinery and shut the plant down for 2 days. They attracted a lot of criticism. The CEO of Vattenfall, the company who owned the mine at the time, described it as massiven kriminellen Gewalttaten. I think I saw massiven kriminellen Gewalttaten performing at Electroworks last week. And it's interesting that he used the word violence, because the activists didn't hurt anybody. They were unarmed, they didn't even damage the machinery, despite being attacked and then arrested by police, and despite being attacked by members of the far-right party Alternative für Deutschland, whose only problem with German coal is that it's brown. So, this is the context in which I would like us to consider today's topic. The Iliad is one of humanity's oldest stories. I studied it in high school, at the same time as I was going through a big anime phase. It tells the story of the invincible warrior Achilles and his friends trying to rescue the Lady Helen from Lord Freezer, and then some androids show up with a bug man, and there's a sequel where they go into space. But the French philosopher Simone Weil says the true protagonist of the Iliad isn't Achilles or Goku. It's actually violence itself. It's almost omnipresent throughout the poem, both glorified and described quite bitterly, almost as if Homer couldn't make up his mind about it. A lot of people seem to be in two minds about violence, especially political violence. The ecologist Andreas Malm was one of the people involved in the action against Schwarzpump. He's been an environmentalist since the early 90s, literally longer than I've been alive. In that time, millions of people have gone on marches, millions of children have taken part in school strikes for climate, there's been letter-writing campaigns and Extinction Rebellion, and with the exception of the Unabomber and a few others, all of that's been completely non-violent. Mom and others say that's pretty remarkable.
It is strange and striking that climate change activists have not committed any acts of terrorism. After all, terrorism is, for the individual, by far the modern world's most effective form of political action, and climate change is an issue about which people feel just as strongly as about, say, animal rights. This is especially noticeable when you bear in mind the ease of things like blowing up petrol stations or vandalizing SUVs. In cities, SUVs are loathed by almost everyone except the people who drive them, and in a city the size of London, a few dozen people could, in a short space of time, make the ownership of these cars effectively impossible just by running keys down the side of them at a cost to the owner of several thousand pounds a time. Say, 50 people vandalizing 4 cars each every night for a month, that's 6,000 trashed SUVs in a month. And the Chelsea tractors would soon be disappearing from our streets, so... why don't these things happen?
Mom also says that this inspiring tradition of nonviolence has failed. In my lifetime, CO2 emissions have accelerated, and there is now more money being invested in fossil fuel infrastructure. If civilization as we know it is to survive, those investments need to be written off.
That means there needs to be no more fossil fuel infrastructure commissioned, and some of what we've already got needs to be dismantled. Mom says the free market ain't going to do that because investors expect profit. And governments have so far been reluctant to make the first move. So Mom... And here I must stress that the views of Dr. Mom are not necessarily the views of Philosophy Tube. Free speech, academic cancel culture, turn around, touch the ground, skin cheese. Mom explicitly recommends sabotage. Massiven Kriminellen Gewalttaten! As the Ender Galander slogan puts it, we are the investment risk. At what point do we escalate? When do we conclude that the time has come to also try something different? When do we start physically attacking the things that consume our planet and destroy them with our own hands? Is there a good reason we have waited this long? Greta Thunberg turning up at COP27 like, right, motherfuckers! To be clear, Mom doesn't want violence against people. He advocates targeted sabotage of fossil fuel-emitting devices like SUVs and power plants as part of a mass movement that remains overwhelmingly non-violent. So he doesn't want guillotines. But he does want people to consider moving from protest to direct action. Given that the vast majority of environmental action is non-violent, a lot of people obviously find that idea a little bit too spicy. It's one thing to express yourself by going on a march, it's another to actually try and do something about it. Some environmental movements, including Extinction Rebellion and Ender Galander in 2016, explicitly rule out the kind of thing that Mom thinks is necessary. He and others say this ruling out of direct action often ignores the history of it working. People remember MLK, they ignore the Black Panthers. They remember Gandhi, they ignore the Indian Mutiny. They remember the suffragettes, but they ignore the suffragettes who planted bombs and threw rocks at Winston Churchill. Can you imagine the reaction you would get throwing stones even at the statue of Winston Churchill now? We wouldn't need nuclear energy. We could power the whole country on the fury of telegraph columnists. And I include myself here. The Stonewall Riot was one of the catalysts for LGBT rights in the English-speaking world, and it wasn't peaceful. Police turned up at the Stonewall Inn in New York and started systematically rounding up and sexually assaulting trans and gay people. So they defended themselves. They threw loose change and then bricks at the police. I'm glad they did that. My life is almost certainly better as a result. And yet, I have political goals now, things that would make my life better again, and I'm not using those kinds of tactics to pursue them. Now, you might say, Abigail, that's because you're a hypocrite and a coward, and you'd rather lie around in a hammock eating French cheese than get off your ass and actually try and do something. And I'd say, well, I don't think that's entirely fair. It's not a hammock, it's a divan. But this is Philosophy Tube. And on this show, we know that the interesting intellectual and emotional stuff comes out when people try to defend the tensions in what they think. So, why do so many people have this discomfort, almost hypocrisy, around violence? Maybe what we need is a clear-cut case to sharpen our critical skills. So, let's take it to the extreme. Let's talk about guillotines. France in the 19th century was an absolute monarchy. That's a political system in which the monarch is not bound by any written law, so they have a right to do anything you can't stop them from doing. They had a lot of debt, and poor people paid more taxes than rich people because rich people wrote all the laws. And rich people had so captured the state that meaningful reform just wasn't happening. Plus ça change, plus la même chose. The people of France decided they'd had enough, so they wrote strongly worded letters and held peaceful protests until the people in charge felt so bad, they changed their ways. I'm just kidding, they cut the king's goddamn head off. And almost immediately, several European politicians and philosophers shit their fucking pants. But one man could always be relied upon to keep his pants firmly unshitted. And that was Prussian philosopher Immanuel Kant. Kant wrote a lot of famous books like The Critique of Pure Reason, Groundwork of the Metaphysics of Morals, Harry Potter and the Metaphysics of Justice, all of which philosophy students will know. But today I want to look at some of his lesser known albums, his later stuff, his B-sides, because Kant actually lived through the French Revolution. I say lived through, he never actually went to France, but he read about it on 19th century Twitter. And he had some thoughts that have puzzled philosophers since, because even Kant had some seemingly contradictory ideas about political violence. On the one hand, Kant was an enthusiastic supporter of the revolutionary cause, so much so that he acquired the nickname the Old Jacobin. The Jacobins were the more radical wing of the revolution. When things first got going, it looked like France might become a constitutional monarchy, like Britain, where you keep the monarch but they have to follow some laws. And the Jacobins were like, oh, une monarchie constitutionnelle, mais que diriez-vous à la place? La guillotine. And eventually they won. Kant thought republicanism was great, the most rational form of government. On the other hand, he condemned killing the king and any kind of violence and even breaking the law. He was very explicit about that. All resistance against the supreme legislative power, all incitement of the subject to violent expressions of discontent, all defiance which breaks out into rebellion is the greatest and most punishable crime in a commonwealth, for it destroys its very foundations. This prohibition is absolute. And even if the power of the state or its agent, the head of state, has violated the original contract by authorizing the government to act tyrannically and has thereby, in the eyes of the subject, forfeited the right to legislate, the subject is still not entitled to offer counter-resistance. And philosophers since Kant have tried to figure out how he squared these two apparently contradictory ideas, liking the French Revolution, but opposing the French Revolution. Kant was quite into what philosophers call social contract theory. It was really big in the Enlightenment. There's lots of different versions, but the basic idea is, imagine a time before society called the state of nature, where there are no laws. It's not a real time like the Dark Ages or the Roman Empire. It's a rhetorical figure, like the age of heroes or the time of gods and monsters. In the state of nature, everybody has authority over themselves. So in that sense, they have a certain freedom. But because people's interests conflict, everybody's fighting all the time. So they come together and they transfer their individual authority to a government so they can decide what to do when people's interests conflict. That way we replace violence with politics. In return, the government might promise to do some stuff like follow the law, depends which version of the theory you're talking about. The problem of organizing a state, however hard it may seem, can be solved even for a race of devils if only they are intelligent. The problem is, given a multitude of rational beings requiring universal laws for their preservation, but each of whom is secretly inclined to exempt himself from them, to establish a constitution in such a way that although their private intentions conflict, they check each other, with the result that their public conduct is the same as if they had no such intentions. And this is why Kant thought that citizens have no right to rise up against their governments or even to question them. Suppose the people of a country felt their government was too harsh, so they started rebelling. The government could turn around and say, the only reason we're being harsh is to quash the rebellion. And who's to decide who's in the right? You can't have another government above the government to decide who's right when the people in the government disagree. The whole point of having a government is they decide what happens when people disagree. Now, at this point, it might be tempting to say that Kant is not only licking boot, he's wrapping the boot in pâté and baking it in pastry. A kind of Wellington boot, if you will. But the key here is, he's not saying challenging the government would necessarily result in disaster, just that it would be intellectually inconsistent. You want to have a social contract, but you also don't want to give up your individual authority. But that doesn't make sense. You can't have both. This is a classic Kantian move, to insist that the thing you want must not be contradictory. If you can grasp what he's doing here, then a lot of the rest of his stuff will start making sense. And generations of philosophy students have felt that same frustration you might be feeling, where it's like, come on, Kant, what are you, a f***ing Vulcan? People aren't 100% rational all the time. We're not consistent. And he'd say, yeah, I know. But you should try. If you're going to use brain, you got to use all brain. And it might not be quite as weird as it appears at first. This idea is actually reflected in international law. We might not like that other countries don't have democracy, but you're not supposed to invade and make them have democracy. You can't want a system of sovereign nations and also want to tell other people what to do. That's a contradiction. Although it does still happen. So, given all this, why did Kant support the French Revolution, an uprising that quite clearly breaks his rules? Kant thought that by watching a revolution and cheering it on, but not taking part in the violence, we create a community of onlookers. The revolutionary goes beyond morality, deliberately breaks the rules of the game. And obviously morality can't ever tell you that it's acceptable to do that. But the spectators stay in the moral zone and engage with the questions that the revolution throws up. By doing so, they develop morally and intellectually, and so humanity progresses. Kant thought that by watching the revolution, people would be inspired to recognize the virtues of republicanism. And so out of evil cometh good. Again, it might be tempting to just say that Kant is being a coward. What, you'd sit on your ass and watch while other people try and build a better world? But he was hundreds of miles away and he was an old man. He wasn't going to be storming the Bastille. And the same is sometimes true today. Not everyone has the opportunity or the ability to blockade a power plant. Engaging with the questions that political violence throws up is not necessarily cowardice. It's kind of the premise of political philosophy. So, let's get engaged. I was not personally involved in the Endegalanda occupation of Swaj Poomp, and statistically, you probably weren't either. And even if you were, you weren't. We were spectators. This time. We have allegedly witnessed some massiven criminellen Gewalttaten, and we can engage with the questions that it throws up. One of which might be, when the police attacked the activists, that wasn't generally called violent. Why not? The philosopher Walter Benjamin had a lot of thoughts on the police. He was living in Weimar, Germany in 1921 when he wrote his famous essay, Critique of Violence. Critique here means investigation rather than criticism. And he certainly had a lot to investigate. Germany had just lost World War I, so the rest of Europe was sending them Venmo requests for reparations. They had a lot of debt. They had food shortages. They had political deadlock. Plus ça change, plus ça même chose. The year before, 1920, German police murdered 42 left-wing protesters outside the Reichstag, the German parliament. There was a right-wing coup called the Kapp-Putsch, which was overthrown after a few days by a general strike. The striking workers decided, hey, we quite like being in charge of our own lives, so they took over an area of Germany called the Ruhr before being absolutely brutally put down by the government they had just saved working with some of the right-wing forces that launched the coup. So if the social contract was supposed to be replacing violence with politics, it didn't seem like it was working. A lot of people were starting to suspect that actually the government was fine with violence, as long as it's against communists. And as the old poem goes, first they came for the communists. Benjamin distinguishes between a few different types of violence. The first is law-preserving violence, like when the police tackle somebody and arrest them. In an ideal world, we could talk to people and persuade them not to hurt each other, but philosophers and normal people have pointed out that sometimes words aren't enough. So the government and their agents, the police, maintain a monopoly on violence, so people can live in peace, even when they might prefer not to. However, that might be a little bit too simple. I don't know about you, but whenever I see people talk about the police, what they do is rarely described as violent. It would be one thing if they said, oh, the police used violence on the Endegalanda activists, but it was justified. But through things like using the passive voice in headlines and only describing what the activists did as Gewalttaten, it seems like what the police do doesn't even count as violence. Benjamin has an explanation for this. He says the police don't do law-preserving violence, at least not exclusively. Their real job is to use what he calls lawmaking or mythic violence, which is itself illegal, but is the foundation of a new legal order. For example, the French Revolution. He says cops regularly do things for security reasons that are completely illegal, and in so doing, they create law on the spot in the interests of the state without democratic oversight. Benjamin really did not like cops. Kind of understandable, given what he'd seen them do. Mythic violence is a bit of a departure from the old social contract idea, where people get together and form a government that represents the general will to limit violence. Rather, Benjamin says that creating a legal order is itself a violent act. When a government is formed, it gathers all the violence into itself and says, right, this violence is acceptable and this violence isn't. And the way it decides isn't a rational decision-making process so much as vibes. For example, blockading a coal mine, bad vibes. Police beating the unarmed people doing the occupying, well, that passes the vibe check. Batman commits violence against criminals. The Gotham police also commit violence against criminals, and probably a lot of people who aren't criminals. But Benjamin says they chase Batman because his violence isn't officially sanctioned. It's a threat to the system, not because it is violent, but because it's the wrong vibes. If you wanted to commit illegal violence against people who haven't been proven to do anything wrong, you should have joined the police. Oh God, it's finally happened. I've been reduced to making philosophical analyses of pop culture. You either die a philosophy tube, or you live long enough to see yourself become Jordan Peterson. Mythic violence is often mythologized, even romanticized, by associating it with symbols like uniforms and flags. If you adopt those symbols, you can give people the impression your violence is sanctioned, even though officially it might not be, and you may even get away with it. Exactly what violence is and isn't sanctioned is deliberately not written down in the law. It's meant to be vague, because then they have a right to do anything you can't stop them from doing. We really are a long way from seeing society as a social contract between rational individuals aimed at limiting violence. Rather, Benjamin sees society as founded in and maintained by violence. He has another kind up his sleeve, though. Divine violence. The exact meaning of this has been hotly debated, but he says that divine violence doesn't establish a new legal order. Rather, it destroys legal order and achieves justice. He's thinking about that general strike that defeated the Kapp Putsch. Maybe he would say that the Endergolander action was divine violence too. There are lots of fictional stories about heroes going beyond the law to dish out divine violence. There's Batman and James Bond and the classic 1966 cowboy film Django, which I hear is being adapted into a TV series. You should watch that when it comes out next year. It's got a lot of very good actors in it. And also me. But a lot of people have wondered whether divine violence is possible in the real world. Can it be done, or will you just end up sparking a cycle of revenge? Will you just end up establishing a new system with its own injustices, in which case what you've actually done is mythic violence, like the French Revolution? One of the big differences between Benjamin and Kant is that whereas Kant sees violence as almost always prohibited, Benjamin's like, oh, well, you know, sometimes it's based. You gotta look at who's doing it and why. And that leads us on to something even more interesting. Another question that we could engage with when spectating the Endergolander action is, was that actually violence? It was Massivan and it was Criminellen, but was it Gewalttaten? A lot of legal texts define violence as involving some kind of physical force or damage, but then threatening somebody is often seen as violent too in law. The Oxford Online Dictionary defines violence as, "Your subscription to the Oxford Online Dictionary has expired. Please click here to renew." Every time I get a dictionary joke, every time. This is potentially a very important issue because the meaning of violence affects how we use other words like threat, protection, security, vulnerable populations, terrorism, intimidating protest. These words can affect our lives in a major way. Think about the difference between describing a group of people as a crowd versus describing them as a mob. One of those words paints them as potentially violent, and these words can be used to enact political control. On the previous episode of this show, we talked about Islamophobia and how the concept of threat can be deployed to paint people as violent, even when there's no evidence. It's really worth taking this in. The idea that calling something violent is itself a kind of metaphorical weapon. Violent people are not usually thought of as having the right to self-defense. If somebody attacks you and you fight back and they kill you, they can't claim self-defense because they started it. So by calling someone violent, you imply that they don't have the right to resist. Politicians and journalists will sell you policies making that move on everything from policing to workers' rights to interpretation of your own country's history. Benjamin said that mythic violence can be used to establish a legal system, and philosophers since him have added that it can also be used to set the boundaries of what even gets to be thought of as violent. And that doesn't mean that we should just throw up our hands and go, oh, well, I guess it's all relative then. Just that whatever definition of violence we employ, we should consider how it's going to be used. We cannot simply start with a definition of violence and then proceed to debate under what conditions violence is justified or not, for we have first to settle the question of which framework is naming violence, through what erasures, and for what purpose. We cannot simply assume a definition of violence and then begin our moral debates about justification without first critically examining how violence has been circumscribed and which version is presumed in the debate in question. A critical procedure would ask as well about the very justificatory scheme at work in such a debate, its historical origins, its presuppositions, and foreclosures. Last week, another mysterious fire ravaged a private medical clinic in Marylebone, causing over £150,000 worth of damage and killing a cleaner. The week before, another blaze destroyed a beautiful house of worship in Islington, once a picturesque feature of the London skyline, now an ugly, smouldering crater. The arson crisis gripping the capital is a national emergency. And almost as bad as the fires themselves is the chilling effect they've had on voices, especially the voices of women and girls, who have legitimate concerns about the fire department. The quality of discourse has declined. Last week, my good friend, Baroness Plantation War Crimes, had stones thrown at her. Metaphorically, in an innocent digital muddle-up, Plantation liked a tweet that was critical of firefighters. And almost immediately, the anti-fire woke mob started baying for her blood just for daring to challenge anti-fire orthodoxy, to accuse Baroness War Crimes, a woman who has spent her entire political career safeguarding the lives and livelihoods that matter most in this country, of encouraging arson is ridiculous, just for liking a tweet that said, firefighters are all and off a balcony into a many reasonable people have legitimate concerns about zealous bans on smoking, oppressive fire safety codes, and Orwellian restrictions as to how much kerosene one can store in one's own house. My brother is a door-to-door petrol salesman, and he says that complying with these Stalinist regulations is driving him almost to penury. He nearly had to sell his second home. But the flesh-eating piranhas, whipping up social media outrage, are only too happy to trample on the rights of honest, hard-working men like him. And even when women and girls speak up, they want to silence us. I heard how Baroness War Crimes was ruthlessly silenced when I saw her on BBC Newsnight and heard her on Radio 4 and 2 and Women's Hour and read her in The Guardian, Observer, Spectator, Telegraph and her new book. The British press will not be intimidated by these anti-fire thugs any more than we are by the transgender Taliban and the intersex intifada. Thank God for groups like Firefighters Against Kerosene Enforcement, an alliance of firefighters and ex-firefighters, standing up for the rights of good citizens against the militant activists in the fire brigade. Thanks to Fake's opposition, there's somebody to check the destructive rampage of wokeness. After all, society must be defended. Simone Weil, the French philosopher who wrote that essay about the Iliad we started with, makes an interesting suggestion. She says that violence or force is the thing that takes away human choice. She wasn't the first person to say this. The 13th century philosopher Thomas Aquinas said that the violent is the opposite of the voluntary. If somebody loses their agency, their autonomy, their ability to affect the world, then violence is the thing that takes that away. To define force, it is that X that turns anybody who is subjected to it into a thing. Exercised to the limit, it turns man into a thing in the most literal sense, it makes a corpse out of him. In whatever aspect, its effect is the same. It turns a man into a stone. From the power to change a human being into a thing by making him die, there comes another power, in its way more extraordinary, the power to make a human being into a thing while he is still alive. He is alive. He has a soul. And yet he is a thing. Strange? A thing with a soul? Strange for the soul! It wasn't made to inhabit a thing. When it is forced to, there is not a single part of it that is not subjected to violence. Vale's definition might prompt some interesting reflections. If she's right, then violence is very common. Raising a child involves denying them choices, so that would be a kind of violence. Compulsory public health measures like mask mandates or vaccine requirements would be kind of violent, as would denying somebody healthcare. The French Revolution, obviously, but also the regime that preceded it. This means that it would be difficult to divide actions into violent and non-violent, which is annoying, because it would be really useful if we could do that. It would be very helpful if there were some particles of violence that we could detect and say, this thing is definitely 20% more violent than this thing. But sadly, it doesn't seem to work that way. Violence is a relationship between the action and the context in which it takes place. We could consider the Swashbuckling occupation to be violent. Mom does. If you sabotage something, then you deny somebody the choice to use it, and that is a kind of indirect violence. But of course, Mom would invite us to consider the context, the much greater, though slower, violence of building and maintaining a coal-fired power plant. And he's not the first person to point this out either. It's been a persistent feature of struggles for racial justice for decades. There is a daily, pervasive state violence that is never spoken of, much less acknowledged, for Palestinians living under a brutal military occupation, for marginalized, disenfranchised young people in British cities or French suburbs, for African Americans disproportionately impoverished, disadvantaged and preyed upon by US police, surviving generation upon generation of institutionalized and violent racism, for the Global South diminished and drained by neoliberal policies imposed upon it by the IMF and the WTO. If it were ever in doubt, the protests in Baltimore have shown us once again that only some types of violence are visible or really matter. The trouble, of course, is that you can't focus on both the action and the context at the same time, hence the weird, almost hypocrisy that we started with. To the Jacobins, the violence of the French Revolution was justified in the context of what came before. But understandably, That came as little comfort to Louis XVI, who still ended up contextually f***ing dead. The million-dollar question is, how do we separate the violence that we care about from the violence that we are willing to accept or believe to be inevitable? And that's kind of what politics is for. When the German police took back the Garzweiler mine, most of the people involved escaped. A few hundred were arrested and then had to be released because they refused to speak to the cops and just clogged up the bureaucracy. There were some charges made, but as far as I can find, nobody was ever convicted of anything. The mine was owned at the time by a company called Vattenfall, who were themselves owned by the Swedish government, who were Social Democrats and Greens. So a clever choice of target. Kind of hard for them to ignore that context. Sadly, rather than shut it down, they sold it to a collection of fossil capitalists from the Czech Republic, and it is still in operation. At time of recording. Step forward. We hear that you are a good man. You cannot be bought. But the lightning which strikes the house also cannot be bought. You hold to what you said. But what did you say? You are honest, you say your opinion. Which opinion? You are brave against whom? You are wise for whom? You do not consider your personal advantages? Well, whose advantages do you consider then? You are a good friend. Are you also a good friend of the good people? Hear us then. We know you are our enemy. This is why we shall now put you in front of a wall. But in consideration of your merits and good qualities, we shall put you in front of a good wall and shoot you with a good bullet from a good gun and bury you with a good shovel in the good earth. By the way, if you've ever wondered how Philosophy Tube is made, then I have some good news for you. We have created a behind-the-scenes documentary about my process and how the show originally got started with the support of CuriosityStream, about whom you probably heard. They are a subscription streaming service. They've got thousands of titles about art and science and history. The documentary has been made by the Philosophy Tube crew, not by me, so I am quite excited to see it, and it will be out by the end of this year, I am told, on Nebula. Nebula is a Streamy Award-nominated platform that I and a few other creators all own a little piece of. They don't have any adverts or demonetization, so it's a good place to put extra stuff like this that might not necessarily fly on YouTube. And the way it works is, if you sign up to CuriosityStream, you get Nebula included for free. They get your subscriptions, you get the documentary, I get a little bit of money for saying this that goes to the people who made the documentary. Just to sweeten the deal though, if you go to curiositystream.com/philosophytube, then you can get 26% off CuriosityStream as well. That means you get them and Nebula for $15 a year. You don't have to sign up to their premium package. You can sign up at the standard CuriosityStream level and you still get Nebula included. I double checked. And there is some really cool stuff on there. For example, I watched a documentary about the French Revolution that had some really cute animations in it and some reenactments that made me smile, and I learned a lot. So click the link in the doobly-doo or go to curiositystream.com/philosophytube.
Did you figure it out yet? What to do with the figurative outlet? I'm running my mouth at heaven. Slept well in a couple of days, trying to figure it out, but I'm stuck in the shapes that I'm handed. Power to the people, they demand it. What kind of power, man, I can't understand it. Was it booming in the Soviet Union? Presuming that it was Lenin that just zoomed in. Was Stalin is a bill? If not, it's an OVF. Common F deserve to get killed. I'm split like the sign of Soviet. Am I just a liberal if I ain't got the point yet? Can't make art if you can't take a stand. But this shit right here, for those still fall. Power to the Soviets, still will defend. Cause it was the first time that they made the attempt.
but left calm and calm, made me cynical, saying Vladimir is just a parliamentary liberal. Not to say that I unite with that position or that vanguardism, it's a politician. I'm still learning on the journey and I'm burning up, cause the planet's getting fucked while I'm yearning for another book, another page, another word of wisdom. Wanna go but also wanna wait to learn more about the system. If you grapple with the word like dialectics, that's okay, take your time, baby. It's a crazy amount we gotta learn just to get shit.
I can't take this bullshit anymore.
What about practice? We gotta talk tactics. Talk class reality spilling on your mattress. Can't go to sleep, think about Marx and shit. You may get the point, but it's still poor marksmanship.
Gotta hit the street, gotta hit a fast.
Gotta get that ass to the mass.
Gotta skip my class.
Gotta be more proletarian than you can be.
Gotta get my theory from beneath the concrete.
Gotta sacrifice life, gotta have less fun.
You don't know what they do with smiles where I'm from.
Got a whip for my back and another for my face.
Bang, bang.
Till I don't crave bourgeois taste.
Forgive me, Lord, for I have sinned and thought in pure petty bourgeois thoughts. Grab me a revisionist so I may resurrect as a true revolutionary, true and perfect.
Listen, comrade, practice is mad important. Unapplied theory, nothing going forward. But sometimes we get stuck inside a fortress. Reading same shit, it gets boring.
Gotta get funky, gotta get creative. Gotta read another paper about battling a slave.
Gotta stick in my hole, gotta do research. I mean, search, then see if it works, yeah.
Emphasis on infinitive styles, and not just reread Mao. Ow, wow, what a life I've been gifted.
Don't wanna sacrifice, but uplifted.
Then have the guns come assisting.
Build up the neighborhood, make it strong.
Break oppressive bonds, make new ones, yeah.
But what do I know? Cause there ain't no Bible describing how to battle for survival.
All I got is curiosity and contradictions that amount,
but also move mountains quite violently.
Revolutionary doubt, I'm searching.
What I'm certain of, I'm carrying out, yeah.
Surprise, Flex.